What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Then they fought furiously in close combat about the body of Alcathous, wielding their long spears, and their bronze armor about their bodies rang fearfully as they took aim at one another in the press of the fight. While the two heroes, Aeneas and Idomeneus, peers of Mars, outvied everyone in their desire to hack at each other with sword and spear. Aeneas took aim first, but Idomeneus was on the lookout and avoided the spear, so it sped from Aeneas' strong hand in vain and fell quivering in the ground. Idomeneus, meanwhile, smote Aeneas in the middle of his belly and broke the plate of his corslet, whereupon his bowels came gushing out and he clutched the earth in the palms of his hands as he fell sprawling in dust.
Idomeneus drew his spear out of the body, but could not strip him of the rest of his armor for the rain of darts that were showered upon him. Moreover, his strength was now beginning to fail him, so that he could no longer charge, and could neither spring forward to recover his own weapon, nor swerve aside to avoid one that was aimed at him. Therefore, though he still defended himself in hand-to-hand fight, his heavy feet could not bear him swiftly out of the battle. Deiphobus aimed a spear at him as he was retreating slowly from the field, for his bitterness against him was as fierce as ever, but again he missed him and hit Ascalaphus, the son of Mars. The spear went through his shoulder, and he clutched the earth in the palms of his hands as he fell sprawling in the dust.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And of course, that was a reading from the one, the only, the Iliad.
Yes, yes, a nice violent passage. One of many violent passages.
Man, the Iliad is stupendously violent. It is like horror movie, blood and guts and gore, violent.
Yeah, yeah. There were a number of passages that kind of called out for possible use here. Another one that I really enjoyed is he, Achilles, struck him in the belly near the navel so that all his bowels came gushing out onto the ground and the darkness of death came over him as he lay gasping.
There's one that always stuck with me ever since, like, years ago when I was reading this, I think in high school or college, whenever it was. It's this I've just got to read it. I can't even describe it.
Go for it.
Idomeneus speared Aramis in the mouth. The bronze point of the spear went clean through it beneath the brain, crashing in among the white bones and smashing them up. His teeth were all of them knocked out, and the blood came gushing in a stream from both his eyes. It also came gurgling up from his mouth and nostrils, and the darkness of death enfolded him round about. Now, it's interesting, of course, in the Iliad, you often see, as with also in the Odyssey, these like repeated lines and phrases that occur over and over.
Yeah,
almost
we heard like clutching the earth with both hands.
Exactly. Fell sprawling in the dust as you're clutching the earth. And then you've got this idea of like the darkness of death enfolded him round about. I think that's also a repeated phrase.
Yeah.
Though the interesting thing about that is it almost the idea of the darkness of death coming in suggests some kind of conscious awareness of death, which if we go back to our old episodes on bicameralism in the Iliad, would seem to go counter Julian Jayne's ideas that you don't see indications of consciousness in the Iliad. Though then again, it's hard to read exactly what that means.
Right. And then, of course, you could also argue that, well, these could be details that were added later and don't relate to the oldest oral traditions of the Iliad.
I guess that would depend on what the scholars of the text have to
say
about
that.
But yeah, it's so interesting that you see all of this horrific violence in the Iliad, but there's also a weird kind of clinical quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Like
when the spear goes into somebody, it describes in disgusting detail all of the things that happen to the bodies and the behavior that responds to it, but we really don't get a lot of a sense of what it feels like to be harmed in battle in the Iliad.
Yeah, it's more like a blow-by-blow, like you're reading the results of a boxing match or an MMA match or something. It reminds me, too, of a trend that you encounter in Arthurian legend. I can't remember which text it was, but I took a course on Arthurian legends back in college, and I remember there being one book, one version of the tales in particular that was just hideously violent, with a lot of people being like stabbed through to the brain. And of course, with those tales, you find equally examples where it's more about the feeling, it's more about the characters and their emotions in other tellings.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's so much that the idea of pain in battle or violent wounding in literature is bound up with, which is that it's not just like burning your hand on the stove, right? Mm-hmm. When you burn your hand on the stove and you're like, ow, and you retract your hand and it's almost a reflexive action. Your brain has been fed information that something is being harmed and you want to stop it as soon as possible and you retreat. In these battle stories, the idea of pain is so deeply emotional and linked up with things like fear of death, sort of the recognition of one's own vulnerability and maybe contemplating the end of one's own life. But you contrast that with these painless, almost robotic soldiers that we see throughout so much of the war literature, especially of the ancient world, like in the Iliad.
Yeah, and the crazy thing, one of the things that we're going to discuss at length in this episode is that you see this sort of ancient trope of the kind of painless soldier, or soldier that is at least not experiencing their pain in the heat of the moment.
Right. Even if it doesn't say that they're painless, at least it's not interested in telling us about the pain. It's just like, it's almost like describing a battle bots or something.
Yeah. But then when you look at where we are now, you can go crazy looking at the various video game scenarios here. I think we've discussed this on the show before. You have very few war games that are really concerned with an emotional level of pain, or certainly with things like PTSD. And then we look to the future, and whether you're dealing with actual military research or just science fiction scenarios, the idea of a painless super soldier, a soldier who doesn't feel remorse or pain, we keep coming back to that again and again, be it in something like The Terminator or the Universal Soldier movies.
Yeah, that is a thing that often in our movies today, they think that they make the villain scarier if the villain doesn't seem to react to pain. I don't know if that's actually always the case. A villain who doesn't seem to react to pain, One example I know you gave, Robert, is in the movie and the book No Country for Old Men. It's definitely there in the movie where you see Javier Bardem is playing this assassin character.
Yeah, and, Anton Chigurh.
Chigurh. Yeah, and he because Josh Brolin tries to call him Sugar.
Oh, yes, yeah. yes, that's right.
But yeah, so Anton Chigurh, he gets like shot and all his body parts and stuff. And he's doing surgery on himself and he's mm-hmm. like barely flinching. And I guess, I don't know. I think that's a great movie, but I do think that part is kind of funny looking back on it now because it's like, ooh, he's so tough. He does surgery on himself and it doesn't even hurt. I don't know. Maybe we should be just as scared or more scared of an assassin who feels normal pain and can lash out emotionally in response to it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's the relentless nature of the character, right? The idea that it cannot be stopped in the same way a normal human can be stopped. It can't be deterred in the normal way. Like you can't count on it just reaching the point where he's saying, oh, this is too painful a scenario. This is too painful a mission for me to keep going with.
Yeah.
And then, of course,
I guess that's the Terminator, right?
Yeah.
The Terminator will not stop. It doesn't feel pain. It doesn't feel pity. It doesn't mm-hmm. feel remorse. It will not stop until it accomplishes its mission. And yet, as we know from Terminator 2, Arnold Schwarzenegger does tell us, I sense injuries. The data could be called pain.
Huh. I forgot about that.
Well, so he says he's aware of when he gets hurt, but it just doesn't stop him from doing anything, you know?
Yeah, well, in this we're getting down to the key purpose of pain, that pain is information about damage and potential damage and potential additional damage that is happening to the body.
So think about the idea of a Terminator that does not sense injuries. Mm-hmm. That's not a very good Terminator, right? Like you could blow its arm off and then it would like maybe still try to hit you with that arm and not even realize it doesn't have one.
Yeah. So in a way it comes down – you could look at the Anton Chigurh character as being just so hyper-focused on the mission that pain doesn't matter.
Right.
Pain doesn't have this additional connotation of like, oh, man, I wonder if my arm's going to work right anymore or is this going to keep hurting? It's more about, is this keeping me from continuing this mission? Is this stopping me in any way? No, it's not, and I'm going to keep moving.
Right. So there definitely does appear to be more to pain than just the sensation of injuries. We should come back to those multiple layers in a minute, but I can't leave the discussion of the painless super soldier without mentioning the villain in maybe one of the stupidest of many extremely stupid James Bond movies. Do you remember The World Is Not Enough from the 90s?
Is this the one that had Madonna in it?
I don't remember. I don't even recall one had Madonna in it. This one had Denise Richards in it.
Was Jonathan Pryce the villain in this one?
No. Okay. No, that is Tomorrow Never Dies, I think. That's the one where the villain is an evil media mogul who keeps writing headlines that are causing wars.
Yeah. I saw that one, but I did not see the one that came after that. So this may be one that's a gap in my Bond movie viewing history.
You know, they're all kind of dumb, but this is definitely not one of the best. This is one of the dumbest of the dumb, and it's got something about a nuclear submarine. I don't even remember the plot, but anyway, the villain in it is this guy who feels no pain. He's got some kind of injury or condition mm-hmm. that prevents him from feeling pain, and this is presented as so tough and so cool. Wow, he can't feel pain. Nothing can stop him, right? And the fact is, that might sound like a superpower, but it is not a superpower at all. If there were actually a person who could not feel pain, and in fact, I don't need to say if there were, there are actually people who don't feel pain or who generally don't feel pain in the same way we do. Like there's a condition called congenital analgesia or congenital insensitivity to pain. These people are born with a genetic condition that prevents them from feeling pain normally. It's not a superpower. It's a really unfortunate condition. If you don't have this condition, you definitely don't want it because people with genetic insensitivity to pain usually can't detect when their body is being injured. So they tend to accumulate untreated injuries and diseases over time without properly seeking treatment or allowing them to heal. Imagine, you know, so you might think, oh, I hurt my leg playing soccer or something. Mm-hmm. And I wish it would stop hurting. But in a way, it's good that it keeps hurting because that prevents you from putting too much weight on it or something, which would continue to maybe exacerbate the injury that you initially had and make the leg less usable and more injured over time.
Yeah, you hear accounts of people in various athletic or sporting scenarios where they push through the pain.
Yeah.
And they're...
That's not good.
Yeah, yeah, there are definite cases where pushing through the pain ends up lengthening the recovery time for an injury and making the injury more severe, mm-hmm. Because they were ignoring the signal from the site of the injury that said, stop using this limb, don't keep going in this particular athletic scenario.
I mean, I can understand the idea of wanting to encourage perseverance in people. Mm-hmm. Perseverance is an important thing for achieving your goals and all that. But there's a difference between perseverance and continuing to hit the punching bag after you've broken a couple of your fingers.
Yeah, but tell that to the Warriors of the Iliad.
Right, exactly. So congenital analgesia is actually – it's very unfortunate for the people who have it, but – There are interesting things about it that it reveals about our nature and what we would do if we didn't have access to the data gathered by our pain sensation. Like one thing I've read about is children with congenital analgesia will often injure their own mouths or fingers by biting them.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you hear about this sometimes too with people who have been numbed up for various procedures. You know, mm-hmm. One has to be careful about, say, chewing the inside of your cheek.
Yeah,
while you're all numbed up.
I'm not sure quite what it is yet. I feel like I'm tapping something kind of interesting there, because it seems that there's this drive within us to perform certain behaviors that, if unchecked by the feedback of pain, would naturally be self-destructive, maybe self-grooming behaviors or even just nervous behaviors.
Yeah, indeed. At what point does the relief of scratching become the irritation of scratching and then become the pain of scratching? You know, it's sort of by degree that one descends ever towards the pain.
Scratching is a good example, though, because it shows that there are certain mental priming conditions mm-hmm. that modulate how we feel pain. Like, for example, if you've got an itch, you will be more able to tolerate repeated scratching behavior on the side of the itch than you would if you didn't have an itch there. Like if you try to scratch yourself mm-hmm. just on the arm or something as much as you would if it was itching real bad, but it's not itching, it starts to hurt and you need to stop. But the brain, because it's itching, just sort of like cuts that off, right? It says, no, keep going.
So obviously we're talking about itching here in reference to pain. Before we proceed any further with this episode, I do want to drive home the fact that obviously Joe and I are professional writers and podcasters. We are not soldiers. We have, I think it would be fair to say, limited experience with physical pain. And I know that various listeners out there are either active members of the military, or they have served in the military, or have experience with intense pain, maybe even chronic pain. So I just want to go ahead and get that out there, make that obvious, and say that, yes, if you have additional insight based on this episode due to your own experiences with pain, we would love to hear from you. So one of my favorite books on the topic of pain that I've actually mentioned on the podcast in the past is Elaine Scarry's The Body in Pain. This is a dense and deep meditation on the vulnerability of the human body. And she points out that when you compare pain to other psychic, somatic, or perceptional states, it's the only one that has no object.
Yeah, interesting.
This is a quote from the book. The objectlessness, the complete absence of referential content, almost prevents it from being rendered in language. Objectless, it cannot easily be objectified in any form, material or verbal. But it is also its objectlessness that may give rise to imagining by first occasioning the process that eventually brings forth the dense sea of artifacts and symbols that we make and move about in. And then she continues, the only state that is as anomalous as pain is the imagination.
That's very interesting, and I think there's some truth to that. Now, obviously, you can think of the idea of pain as something that would have an object in some scenarios, mm-hmm. as in, something similar to touch. Like, if there's a source of heat on the hand, that could be pain, and that could maybe be thought of as an object. But then again, pain can exist independent of a specific stimulus like right. that. It's just it's almost like the pain takes place in a theater of the mind that's deeply connected with the experience of touch in the body.
Yeah. I love how she compares it to imagination here. And it reminds me of the theories of our old friend, American psychologist Julian Jaynes.
Yeah, who we just mentioned earlier.
Yeah, who wrote of imagination and the quote, dance of the self. As you probably remember from our episodes on the bicameral mind, he explored the idea that ancient humans were not conscious in the modern sense of the word, and that prior to roughly 1200 BCE, the brain used language to convey experience from the right to left hemisphere. Modern consciousness, therefore, is a learned development tied to metaphorical language.
Yeah, so the idea here was that we modern humans use conscious thought to entertain and simulate responses to novel stimuli. So when something new and unexpected happens and you can't deal with it just by, you know, sort of like rote learned behavior and you need to do something novel, we think about it, right? We have a conscious experience where we try to work out what to do. Whereas pre-conscious people instead would have this bicameral situation. They would encounter a situation that called for novel behavior, and instead they would experience a hallucinated voice that would internally tell them what to do. And Jaynes believed this to be the non-dominant hemisphere of the brain synthesizing information and planning behavior, and then delivering those behaviors as hallucinated commands to the dominant hemisphere to be acted out. And of course, he called this hypothetical, unconscious, hallucinating past human a bicameral person. But if you go with Jaynes' hypothesis, which of course is unproven, it's a very interesting hypothesis, but I think we're still waiting for, you know, more good evidence to evaluate its merits. But since we've established that so much of what we think about when we think about pain is not just the sensory data, but some kind of conscious experience, some relationship to the imagination, that his theory would definitely change what, like a bicameral person would have to experience pain differently, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he actually considered this a little bit. He wrote a paper titled Sensory Pain and Conscious Pain, and it was published in a 1985 edition of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. In this, he discussed the differences between sensory pain and conscious pain. On one hand, we have pain with a purpose. Pain is an instructional sensation intended to alert us to harm. You can call it a, depending on, you know, where you're approaching it from, you may call it acute pain or nociceptive pain or sensory pain, as Jaynes liked to call it. But then there's chronic pain, psychological pain, or as Jaynes calls it, conscious pain. And this is where we would have a conscious reaction to the sensory pain.
Okay, so in Jaynes' formulation, the Terminator would probably be kind of like the bicameral person, right? Who would have access to sensory pain. I sense injuries. The data could be called pain. But the pain doesn't necessarily bother him, right? Or bother the Terminator. It doesn't like linger in the mind and have these echoing conscious effects through the imagination. It is just data that is received about something happening to the body right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reluctant to go with a full-on Terminator explanation because I think one of the, based on my readings of the bicameral mind, I don't want to fall into the habit of making it seem too much like the bicameral human is a complete machine, that they are inhuman. But anyway, in this paper, Jaynes, he explores this idea. It's important to note that a lot of this is Jaynes just asking questions in this paper. He's not saying, this is my definite theory on pain sensation in ancient peoples. He's saying, well, I have this theory called the bicameral mind. Perhaps you've heard of it.
Mm-hmm.
Here are some questions I have about pain.
How would this apply?
Yeah. And so he draws on some examples. From his typical resources, ancient classical history. And he points out that we find no examples of chronic pain in ancient literature. And he points to a few examples to support this idea. He says that ancient Proto-Indo-European languages before around 2000 BCE had no word for pain or hurt at all, only for cuts and wounds.
I wonder if that's true. Experts out there listening of ancient languages, is that true to you? Or can you think of counterexamples?
Yeah, I would love to hear. And, you know, Jaynes, we should also point out, he admitted pretty openly that he did not speak, say, Mandarin or Hindi. So he himself did not explore evidence for or against his theories with any real depth in those cultures. Mm-hmm. So if you have some linguistic evidence from either of those cultures or other cultures that James didn't cover, I'd love to hear from you. He also points out that the oldest parts of the Iliad written down in 850 BCE, based on older oral traditions, that in these cases we have extremely gory depictions of battle wounds, but hardly any notice of discomfort. In these examples, he says, pain is merely pain behavior.
Now, I did a quick search to see what was mentioned about pain in the Iliad, and I found plenty of examples of what seemed to me to be something like conscious pain. Just one example is when a wounded King Menelaus mm-hmm. is promised that he'll be given herbs by a surgeon to relieve his pain from wounds. So that sounds like conscious pain to me, right?
Yeah.
Like if he's seeking relief of the pain through some kind of medication, that would indicate consciousness of the pain. But then again, perhaps these are references, these references might be parts of the narrative that are what James is considering later additions to the manuscript tradition and not part of the early core of the text. I don't know enough about the manuscript history of the Iliad to speculate on that.
Yeah, it could conceivably be an example of an editor coming along and saying, shouldn't we add something about how this feels here? This seems like a rather painful situation.
And there are plenty of examples of that kind of thing in the ancient world. Like a lot of ancient texts appear to be composed in multiple stages.
Yeah. Now, again, in all of this, James was asking a lot of questions, and he points out that if this were the case, it would mean that infants and animals would be incapable of true chronic pain, such as, for instance, phantom limbs. So if anyone out there has any additional information on that, I would love to hear from you. I did some brief research on the matter, and I could not find any accounts of animals with phantom limbs where, you know, where an individual has lost a limb and is experiencing the sensation of pain from where that limb should be.
Now, as I've said on the podcast before, I always want to be careful about the bicameral mind, maybe mainly because it's one of those things that's so interesting, I feel like I have to be suspicious of it. You know, I have to be too careful that I'm not getting sucked in by it just because it's fascinating and fun to think about. But of course, as we said before, it remains unproven. I think the jury's still out about where the evidence fits into the hypothesis, but it is always interesting to play around with.
Yeah, and I'd love to come back to it at some point and discuss it a bit more on the show. Now, one thing to keep in mind in all of this is that, you know, we're talking about James's take on this sort of dual system of pain. And no matter what the status of James's larger theory is, the dual systems of pain, this is widely accepted. And it gives us an idea of what war without pain in the ancient world or in the not too distant future might be like. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will discuss this pain that is all in your head. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
All right, we're back.
You know, pain can be more tricky to define than you might think, because pain is something you definitely know when you experience it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to like put down an objective third-party definition that will cover everything that is pain and not cover anything that is not pain, it gets kind of difficult, right?
Like, oh yeah.
What is the difference between pain and discomfort? If you've got your leg tucked up under you while you're sitting in a chair, and over time that leg starts to feel not good and you want to move it because it's been stuck that way for a while, is that pain or is that discomfort, and what's the difference?
Yeah, I mean, this is encountered all the time by medical professionals trying to diagnose an illness, like determining, all right, well, where does your pain scale on, say, a 1 to 10?
Yeah,
and then how am I supposed to use that information? But then, what is 1 to 10 for you?
Yeah,
I feel like when I'm asked that by a physician, I'm always like, well, obviously, I have not felt anything from an 8 up, so I'm not going to classify anything I'm feeling now that high on the scale.
But some people might start with a 10.
Yeah. And then it's also like an example that comes to mind is during yoga.
Mm-hmm.
Generally what most yoga practitioners will say is, you know, don't do anything that feels painful. If you're experiencing pain, you need to pull back.
Right.
But I see this all occasionally with individuals who are taking classes that I'm in. I'll see that there are some people who think it is more tolerable to push through a certain amount of discomfort into pain,
yeah,
where they're not just merely working the body part, but they are working it too hard, but they don't realize they should back up. So it's almost like we all have a different translation of the pain, a different kind of emotional translation of the basic information that our mind is presented with.
On the other end of the scale, I guess going into the more conscious or chronic type thing that we were discussing earlier, pain, like what's the difference between pain and fear or pain and sadness and all these emotions that, I mean, there are cases where there seems to be a relationship between the idea of somatic pain, like I've got chronic pain in my body and I can't move, like it hurts to move about, can be deeply linked to psychological conditions in the brain like depression.
Yeah.
And yet everything is getting rolled up under this rubric of pain, which is, essentially pain at its most basic level is, as we've said, information. It tells you about when something is being injured or is suffering a disease. But anyway, just to get a definition on the table that we can maybe work with, the International Association for the Study of Pain says that quote, pain is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience that is associated with actual or potential tissue damage or described in such terms.
Okay.
That last clause seems to do a lot of work, huh?
Yeah, that kind of twists it, kind of expands the umbrella of the definition, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I think it's interesting there that even in their definition, they roll up the emotional experience with the idea of the sensory experience, right? Like it's totally baked in.
Indeed. But do we see that in the origin of the word itself?
Well, I was wondering about this. So the origins of the English word pain do not come from the idea of sensations in the body. The word pain originally comes from Latin poena or pena, meaning punishment or penalty. Mm. And you can think about this in, if you think about like the archaic usages of pain in medieval language, right? What happens to you if you break the king's laws? Well, you break them on pain of death. It's like the penalty specified for something.
Yeah, and of course, when you think about official punishment, either in the term, you know, be it a you know, public execution or some sort of public torment, mm-hmm. there's generally some sort of arguably emotional context to it, some sort of humiliation that is involved, or at least something instructional for mm-hmm. the society. It's been pointed out to me before that you look back on these various modes of public punishment or public execution, and there's always some level of drama there. There's some level of instruction that is baked into it that the individuals perceiving the act or hearing of it would be privy to.
Well, I mean, you think about this in depictions of hell in yeah. the ancient world. I think of either, say, Dante's Inferno, or if you look at like some of the apocryphal Gospels and Revelations where they see visions of hell. I'm thinking there's some early apocalypse of Peter. It's not in the Bible. It's this mm-hmm. apocryphal text, but where Jesus reveals visions of hell to Peter. And in a lot of these stories, you get very ironic punishment. So it's not just that a wicked person or an unredeemed person is being punished in hell in a kind of generally unpleasant way, but the pain that is inflicted on them seems to have some ironic relationship to what they did wrong.
Yeah.
You know, blasphemers will have their mouths burned or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, in all of this, again, pain is information. And then the brain receives that information and decides what sort of attention it deserves. So if the brain were running a newspaper, it would decide whether it demanded front page treatment, if it went above or below the fold, and how big the font needed to be.
Yeah.
And in the same way that a newspaper editor might enhance or downplay a bit of news, so too does the brain determine whether a particular pain signal at a given point should be amplified or reduced.
Right. I mean, this might be given in our scratching example, right? Mm-hmm. Like sometimes you scratch too much and that feels really bad, but if you've got an itch, the brain just says, okay, go ahead, go to town.
Yeah, it's kind of like an itch would be below the fold story, like mosquito bite produces mild irritation for the human. Mm-hmm. But then once you've scratched it enough, it gets above the fold and said dumb human has scratched mosquito bite to the point of actual physical pain.
But then you go back to the brain and be like, you made me do that. That's your fault.
Yeah, that's the media at work.
The scratching
yeah.
should have hurt earlier.
Now, as pointed out by David Linden, a professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University, we see this in battle scenarios all the time. And you can easily argue that this is what's happening in the Iliad. A soldier receives a wound and barely feels it at all, at least at that time. And then later they might recoil at the prick of a doctor's needle during treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So the brain here, of course, is using two systems to process incoming pain signals. One system determines location, intensity, and characteristics. So to go back to our Iliad example, Enomas, his brain registers intense smoting damage to his lower abdomen.
Smoting damage.
Yeah. And then meanwhile, you have this other system that deals with the emotional characteristics of the wound. And this would be Enomas thinking, by the gods, Adominius, that Cretan villain just sliced me open and I'm dying so far from the kingdom of Pisa, falling into the kingdom of the dead, etc. Uh-huh. Right? There's this emotional context to the injury. And so these two systems work together and influence how we actually experience pain. If you feel safe, calm, and protected, then that can lessen the pain. Likewise, Linden points out that humiliation and an unpredictable schedule of pain, these have aided torturers for centuries. Being able to, you know, make the torture victim feel like they don't know when the pain is going to come at them, and adding this just intensified emotional context to it.
Oh, totally. I mean, the emotional context of pain is incredibly powerful. And here's something I bet a lot of you out there have experienced. Robert, I wonder if this has ever happened to you. You ever go to the doctor with a pain that mm-hmm. you're worried about? Like something's hurting on your body. You don't know what's causing it. You go to the doctor. Doctor looks at it, says, can't find anything wrong, and the pain just goes away.
Well, I don't know.
Like immediately.
I don't think I've had that exact scenario, but I have had situations where, like, I have a shoulder problem that uh-huh. was bothering me for a while. Went to the doctor, and they were like, I don't know. We can't figure it out. We could do more tests, I guess. And so I was just kind of at that point. I said, well, I guess I'll just keep doing what I'm doing and see what happens. And it went away.
Yeah.
So maybe that's like a less direct manifestation of the same thing.
I mean, I think I've heard about other people telling stories like this before, where you've just got some complaint in your body. Often it is a pain that seems to be localized somewhere. And as soon as you're told it's nothing to worry about, it basically just leaves you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not only are you being told not to worry about it, but you're going to a place where you're going to feel rather safe and
yeah.
control. Like even before the doctor looks at you, you're in an environment of perceived safety regarding the injury. Like at least now I'm among the experts and they'll be able to weigh in on it.
But if it can leave like that, that makes you wonder, where did it come from?
Mm-hmm.
Right? What caused this thing to make my brain think I was hurting in a place where as soon as I was told I didn't actually need to be hurting there, I stopped hurting?
Well, you know, we're not going to get into faith healers in this episode, but it does make one think of all the various religious healers throughout history who have either just merely laid hands on an injury or on a forehead
mm-hmm.
or administered some form of treatment that ultimately is nothing more than placebo.
But another big way that psychology, that like the state of the mind can influence the experience of pain, can be not just like the relief of pain, but like failing to notice pain to begin with, right?
Yeah, and we have accounts of that from throughout recorded history. One of the most frequently quoted passages about this comes from the Roman philosopher Lucretius from he lived 94 through 55 BCE.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about the scythed chariots. So these chariots with these big rolling blades, you know, on the wheels. It said the scythe chariots reeking with indiscriminate slaughter suddenly chop off the limbs. Such is the quickness of the injury and the eagerness of the man's mind that he cannot feel the pain. And because his mind is given over to the zest of battle, maimed though he be, he plunges afresh into the fray and the slaughter.
I know in reality that's not funny, but the zest of battle.
Yeah.
The zest.
It makes it sound like a soap commercial, right?
Right. Like zesty battle dressing.
Yes. Zestfully dead. That sort of thing.
But so the idea there is that a really rapidly inflicted wound on a soldier who's engaged in the heat of battle, like if it chops their arm off, they might not even notice. So they just keep trying to fight.
Yeah. And it's only later that they may experience the emotional pain of
right.
what's happening. So I was reading some information about this, and Joanna Bork, writing for The Conversation, she points to Surgeon A. Copland Hutchinson's writings in 1816's Some Practical Observations in Surgery, and he wrote that soldiers and seamen with limbs that required amputation didn't realize the extent of the damage, quote, at the time of their being wounded. They were scarcely sensible of the circumstance till informed of the extent of their misfortune by the inability of moving their limb.
Hmm.
So war surgeons, they've tended to chalk this up to the excitement of battle, that zest of battle, or to the ideological ideals that animated them.
Right.
Or to the psychological effects that of the battle that put them in a sort of trance, you know?
Right.
Now, we mentioned the placebo effect briefly. The father of the placebo effect was an ethicist, Henry K. Beecher, who questioned some 215 wounded men in Italy between 1943 and 1945, and he found no necessary correlation between the severity of the wound and the amount of pain that the men expressed.
So yet again, it seems to be highly contingent on psychological factors.
Right. Yeah. You can't just say, okay, this is the amount of discomfort that is that accompanies, the loss of a hand.
Yeah. Which is funny because that seems to make it very difficult to create a standardized scale of pain.
Yeah.
Which are, you mentioned the 1 to 10 scale to ask you at the doctor's office or at the hospital. I've thought about before, like, there have been attempts to rate on a standardized scale how much it hurts to get attacked by certain types of insects.
Yes.
Have you ever read about this?
Yeah, the pain, what is it?
The sting scale. I don't recall exactly who the researcher was, but there was a guy who put one of these together, and he was like, I've been attacked by a bullet ant and a tarantula hawk and all of the worst insects, and I've ranked them on a scale of how bad it hurts. And it just seems like you can't actually do that, can you? Like, some things probably will reliably hurt most of the time more than other things, but pain is very much in the brain of the receiver of the injury.
Yeah, and we're still trying to figure out how the brain regulates our individual perceptions of pain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Beecher himself, he initially expected that the men who expressed little or no pain were insensitive due to some chemical or hormonal imbalance. But he later theorized that they were not suffering or were suffering less because to be injured and off the front lines during this time was to be safe, to be removed from the prime place of danger.
Huh.
Now, you compare that to the average civilian situation where if you're suddenly in a hospital, you were in the place of danger. You were in the place where people not always, but a place where people may often die. This is the place of injury, the place of I mean, not only a physical injury, but say emotional, financial injury, all these anxieties that are swarming around actual physical ailment. Whereas again, on the front lines of battle, if you are in the hospital, then you are in a place of safety.
Wow, I've never thought about it like that before, but that does make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, Beecher's work and that of others, they reveal the truth of the matter. Emotions matter in war. Fear and anxiety matter in war.
Yeah.
But then what are we to do with it, both for the betterment of humanity and to improve our ability to wage war?
Well, yeah, you can think about this in two very different ways. So we have the idea of people who are always going to be injured and harmed in war. And so there's sort of like the good magic of coming up with ways to relieve chronic pain for people, especially people who have been injured in battle. You want them to be able to live normal lives, to live without pain and suffering. And like, how can we help them? And then there's the darker magic aspect of it, which is people trying to figure out, how can I make more effective soldiers who are not hampered by pain?
Yeah, we see this time and time again, of course, with technology. You can look to the advancements in chemistry from the 19th and early 20th century, advancements that were, you essentially had the chemistry of life, and then you had the chemistry of death. It
gave
us some of our most nefarious chemical weapons.
Exactly. And so maybe you're wondering, like, wait a minute, why would trying to create a soldier who doesn't feel pain on the battlefield, like, why would that be the dark magic? Why would you be worried about that? Isn't that good if they're not feeling pain? I would say no, not necessarily, because we come back to, yet again, pain is important information on the battlefield. You don't want people who have left the battlefield to have to feel chronic pain all their lives, right?
You
would like to be able to give them relief for that. But if you're in the heat of battle, if you're still in a situation where threats are continuously coming your way and you haven't made it back to the hospital or back to your regular life, pain is important. That's something you need to know that could save your life. If you're not getting the data, and if you're not feeling the pain that will help prevent you from, moving forward with a life-threatening injury, you are putting yourself at risk.
Indeed. And of course, there are some additional ethical concerns there that we'll get to later on in the episode. All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll discuss some past examples of attempts to manipulate the way that we feel pain, as well as some current and near future advancements that might change the way soldiers experience pain.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
All right, we're back.
Now, on this podcast, we've covered pharmacological alterations of soldiers for better service, right? I think, Robert, you and Christian did an episode on combat stims, right?
Yes. Yes, we did.
Like all of the drugs that armed forces authorities have tried to make soldiers take in order to be more alert and more effective.
With one notable exception, which we're going to correct in this episode, but yes.
But obviously, one more way to enhance a soldier, as I said earlier, at the expense of their safety and long-term survival, is to make them unable to feel pain. But of course, just pumping a soldier full of like OxyContin or Vicodin or morphine is running the risk of addiction and overdose. But also, these drugs come with side effects that could make soldiers less effective, right? Drowsiness, lethargy, complacency.
Yeah, because you need your soldier to be effective in their role.
Right.
So whatever is correcting one perceived area of weakness, you don't need it to weaken other areas as well.
Right. So if you're one of these, you know, imagineers of war, the people who are trying to come up with ways for soldiers to press on in battle and continue to be more effective, mm-hmm. often at the expense of the soldier themselves, one thing that would be amazing to come up with would be like a pain vaccine. And there have apparently been efforts in exactly this area. So the defense journalist Annie Jacobson has a 2015 article in The Atlantic about attempts at DARPA over the years to re-engineer the human body for war. And here's one story she tells. In 1999, DARPA created a subdepartment called the Defense Services Office, or the DSO, which was run by a biologist and venture capitalist named Michael J. Goldblatt, who, incidentally, I looked up what he's up to now. He appears more recently to have been appointed to the scientific advisory board of an organization called Cannabis Science.
Oh, okay. So he's gotten away from the DARPA stuff.
as far as we know. Now, Jacobson writes that Goldblatt, quote, believed that defense sciences could demonstrate that the next frontier was inside of our own selves, and he became a pioneer in military-based transhumanism, the notion that man can alter the human condition fundamentally by augmenting the body with machines and other means. Mm. And so Goldblatt's got this transhuman idea, but it sounds like he's working out the baby steps getting you towards transhumanism by starting with the military.
Well, it's when you look at where advancements take place, I mean, it's pretty sensible. If you want the budget to elevate the human experience via technology, the military is the right place to go for funding.
I mean, honestly, when you look at a lot of these DARPA contracts, you really get the sense that a lot of the researchers working on this stuff are just trying to advance some obscure scientific medical or technological field, and they're coming up with whatever justifications they can to make it sound like this is relevant to military technology.
Yeah, I mean, not to use him as an example for all military researchers by any means, but we of course explored that with John C. Lilly. He seemed to have always been interested about connecting with other minds and understanding what other mind states consisted of.
Right.
And early on in his career, that meant working for the government and exploring some kind of frightening concepts.
Yeah.
He was game for it.
I want some psychic dolphins. How can I get some war money to do it?
Well, sort of, yes.
No, sorry, that's not.
Well, the dolphins came later, but I mean, as we explored in that episode, certainly that's where the isolation tanks were born.
Yeah. So going back to the story of the DSO, so Goldblatt ran the DSO until 2004. And when he spoke to Jacobson, there were still many classified aspects of his work that he couldn't reveal, but he did say he believed that, quote, soldiers having no physical, psychological, or cognitive limitation will be key to survival and operational dominance in the future. With the age of robotics, I'm not sure if many people would still say that's the case. Like, if you just need no physical, psychological, or cognitive limitations, I don't know. Maybe it'd be better to be putting robots in those risky scenarios, but
then you get into the various challenges to making the ideal robotic combatant. Right?
That's true. Well, humans can of course do many things that robots can't yet do.
Right, including make certain judgment calls. Even though certain judgment calls are going to be challenging even to a human in various combat scenarios, especially when it concerns say non-combatants and being able to tell when an individual is a non-combatant,
yeah,
et cetera.
Right. So if you had like ideal ethical war, though that seems like, you know, it's a difficult thing to try to work out, but mm-hmm. it would be full of ethical soldiers who were operating on ethical principles using human judgment that's difficult for robots to master.
Right.
But along the lines of what Goldblatt said, there was one DSO project which was known as Persistence in Combat, and it sought to eliminate three problems that limit a soldier's effectiveness on the field of battle. And these problems are pain, wounds, and excessive bleeding. And for the pain part, quote, Goldblatt hired a biotechnology firm to develop a pain vaccine. If a soldier got shot, Goldblatt explained, the vaccine would, quote, reduce the pain triggered by inflammation and swelling, the desired result being, quote, 10 to 30 seconds of agony, then no pain for 30 days.
So basically the level of pain that Arnold Schwarzenegger's character experiences in the movie Commando. Right, where he's like shot in the shoulder and it's like, ah, at first, but then he's just running around like normal.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And of course, what's the goal of that? Well, Jacobson comes out and says the goal is that a vaccine like that would allow the fighter to continue fighting as long as the bleeding could be stopped.
Okay.
Again, this sounds like putting the soldier at more risk of death and permanent injury, but that seems to be what they were trying to figure out how to do. And as a side note, apparently their plan to immediately stop bleeding. Do you know what this was?
No, do tell.
On the battlefield, a soldier's bleeding a lot, and their plan was to inject the soldier with a payload of millions of tiny magnets, which could then be directed to coagulate in the blood with the positioning of a magnetic wand.
Oh, so either they would have a wand or there would be like a field medic that would come up and just sort of wand the wound, and then that would cause the magnetic particles to assemble.
Yeah.
Wow.
No word on whether that's still in development.
Hmm. Now, we mentioned the previous episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind that dealt with combat stims. Well, there was one particular drug that we did not cover in that episode, and that was pervitine, an early version of what we now call crystal meth. And it was available quite legally in Nazi Germany and used throughout the military engine of the Third Reich.
Crystal meth, huh?
Yeah, essentially it was essentially a methamphetamine. Now, as Megan Gerber pointed out in her excellent Atlantic article, Pilot Salt, the Third Reich kept its soldiers alert with meth. The benefits went beyond mere wakefulness.
Uh-huh.
So she writes that author Heinrich Boll, an influential post-World War II German writer, wrote about this a bit. He was conscripted into the German military in his early 20s, and at the time, even, he wrote about the use of pervitine. He said that when using the drug, he was able to forget for a while about the trials and tribulations of war.
So it sounds like a numbing of psychological pain.
Exactly. Now, at the time, Der Spiegel described the drug produced by drug maker Timmler Werke as, quote, the ideal war drug. So the idea is you would have an army of euphoric soldiers. The German military pumped millions of these pills out to its troops, where it was also known as Panzer Schokolade, or tank chocolate, and pilot salt in the Luftwaffe. But according to Gerber, quote, between April and July of 1940, more than 35 million 3-milligram doses of pervitine were manufactured for the German Army and Air Force. But again, this was essentially crystal meth. There were side effects: heart failure, psychotic phases, suicide. The British also experimented with a similar substance, and they found that it resulted in just too much agitation, aggressiveness, and impaired judgment. But as far as pain goes, well, a 1948 article in the American Journal of Psychiatry, it hits on a few points related to the emotional side of pain. The paper states, quote, pervitine produces an emotionally charged free flow of material, which may include painful memories, traumatic experiences, intimate personal fantasies, and delusional ideas. Most patients experience a dramatic relief of tension and feeling of relaxation. Mild depressions are often delayed. The psychologically rich response evoked by pervitine is helpful both diagnostically and therapeutically. Now, from this, though, it sounds like you're again coming down to an individual's pre-existing psychological state and how they perceive pain, because it sounds like pervitine could suppress the emotional aspects of the pain or mm-hmm. cause them to surge up to the surface, depending on the individual.
I mean, I would have to observe yet again, as we've seen with many of these things so far, the idea here seems not so much for the benefit of the soldier themselves, but for the benefit of the war aims as a whole at the expense of the soldier.
Yes. Now, another idea that comes up a lot in the literature surrounding this topic is the idea of an anti-remorse pill.
Oh, that's a horrible idea.
Yeah. But it makes sense, right? If fear and remorse interfere with a soldier's ability to inflict pain or suffer pain themselves, then it would seem natural to simply remove it. But of course, at the same time, nothing could be more unnatural.
Right.
So as of now, there is no such thing as a true anti-remorse pill. But Columbia University researchers have isolated the gene behind a protein in mice that inhibits fear. And meanwhile, trauma-inducing drugs have been trialed at Harvard University for car accident victims.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Gregory Quirk of the University of Puerto Rico has experimented with the use of magnetic stimulation to aid patients in unlearning fear. And these were just a few examples brought up by Joe and Greta Bird in their 2005 article, Human Rights in the Military, The Chemical Soldier, that was published in Alternative Law Review. Now, a quick note on Dr. Gregory Quirk. His work continues. He continues his work into pain. And the study mentioned above was the effect of repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation on fear extinction in rats, and that was published in the journal Neuroscience. His findings suggested that, quote, repeated transcranial magnetic stimulation paired with trauma-reminding stimuli enhances fear extinction, and that RTMS in conjunction with exposure therapy is potentially useful for facilitating extinction memory in the treatment of PTSD. So a lot of this research does seem to be aimed more at treating PTSD, which would certainly benefit soldiers. But I wonder if it's a bit much to describe it as an anti-remorse pill.
Well, yeah, what that conjures to mind is like a pill that you would give a soldier before going onto the battlefield so that they can like commit atrocities and not worry about it. If it's just to help a soldier after they've come home to like not experience PTSD, that sounds to me like a good thing.
Yeah, but I guess it comes back again to the dual nature of technology. If you're working on the cure, then a lot of times the same science is involved in creating a more effective poison.
I guess that's true. I mean, you mentioned the idea of treating car accident victims. I mean, no matter what, if you are working on ways to help extinguish fear in the mind mm-hmm. and help people get over trauma, you can certainly see ways that same knowledge and technology and medicine could be leveraged to try to get people to do things that they shouldn't want to do.
Indeed. Now, in 2015, then DARPA program manager Doug Weber challenged labs, quote, to develop tools that will establish direct communication and delivery of information to the nervous system. This, according to the Christian Science Monitor. The key reason here? To manipulate their nerves, enabling the control of blood pressure as well as the manipulation of adrenaline to curb fear and anxiety. And then Weber says, quote, that would be especially useful for our warfighters who have to deal with very stressful environments. So the challenge here is, of course, to create drugs and drug delivery systems that operate with a certain amount of balance and dependability. You want your soldiers calm and collected, but not doped out or amped up to the point where they make irrational decisions. Likewise, you don't want crippling dependency or hangover effects. So the alchemy of the perfect soldier seems to be rather detailed. You know, you want to have your soldier just right. And if you're trying to manipulate the stats in one direction or the other, you risk putting the entire algorithm out of balance.
Now, I know we are in the last minutes here going to get into discussing the idea of super soldiers of the future. But before we go to that, I want to ask the question, if you are manipulating soldiers pharmacologically, technologically, trying to alter their psychology and their response to pain, if you're making all these tweaks, are the interests of the soldier as a person who just wants to be a person and try to live their life always going to be at odds with the interests of the commanders and the people who are coming up with the war aims and the strategies? Are these things just inevitably in tension, or could there be scenarios where those interests are aligned, where they're the same thing?
Well, certainly in this we're getting into a number of the ethical concerns involved
right
here. And luckily there are individuals who have been writing about this and continue to write about this in order to inform the individuals who are in the position to make decisions about our use of treatment and preventative measures for pain on the battlefield. In 2015, Dave Shunk explored the idea in Ethics and the Enhanced Soldier of the Near Future for the Military Review.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the following points. He said that, first of all, the soldier of the future likely will be enhanced through neuroscience, biotechnology, nanotechnology, genetics, and drugs. He said they will perform more like a machine than a human. And he says that there's a basic ethical problem with using therapeutic drugs for performance enhancement. But we have to also worry about the, quote, unforeseen ethical challenges and the second and third order effects of such warfare. He says, what are the ethics of fighting an enemy-enhanced soldier who does not feel pain? Will the only way to stop that soldier in battle be to cause severe trauma or death?
Yeah, this is sort of what I was imagining. So imagine on the other side of the battle, there are people who are coming at you,
mm-hmm.
and they're also soldiers on their side. They're just doing what they're commanded by their commanders, and they've been given, say, a version of this pain vaccine that the DSO is trying to create. And you basically can't stop them without maiming or killing them.
Yeah.
And if the soldiers on your side have equal types of enhancements, maybe you can't be stopped without being maimed or killed. Does this increase the body count on both sides?
Yeah, Joe and Greta Bird in the 2005 article "Human Rights in the Military: The Chemical Soldier," which we referenced earlier, they summarize this idea, this fear quite nicely. Quote, "The context of 20th century warfare is characterized by a movement to dehumanize the enemy. The enemy does not have a face. Military training tends to turn the other into non-human and the self into the machine, in the sense that to be human is to have emotions of empathy, fear, and compassion and remorse. Both sides are dehumanized." And I mean, that's what we keep coming back again and again in this situation, is that you're not only dehumanizing the enemy, you're dehumanizing the military on your side as well.
Right.
You're talking about making them less human to better aid them in this endeavor.
Well, there are a lot of conventions of military behavior that are clearly premised on psychological de-individuation, right? Mm-hmm. Why does the military all wear matching uniforms? You could think, well, that's somewhat useful because you can see who's on your side if they've got the same uniform. But also, when people put on uniforms, they start to act more like a team and less like an individual making individual decisions.
Right.
You're more just sort of like a cog in the machine functioning smoothly. Now, that might be useful in getting some things done, but it also might remove some of your individual sense of judgment about what you should do. And this, of course, isn't just like a recent discovery. Like, you know, these types of uniforms and things like this go way back into ancient history.
Yeah. Now, to go back to the writings of Joe and Greta Bird here, they said remorse is regarded as a marker of the psychologically healthy individual. The failure to experience this emotion is an indication of psychopathy. If an anti-remorse drug is developed and administered, a soldier's sense of remorse could be chemically altered so that they could kill or rape civilians in the context of war without the guilt experienced by healthy individuals. This chemical enhancement of soldiers would not affect a state's liability at international law. So, which was, again, one of the primary ideas here because it was an alternative law journal. But still, I feel like they really hit a nerve here talking about this, the dehumanizing aspect of this kind of scenario where you're creating a better soldier, but in doing so, you're creating a less human soldier. And then what does that do to war as a human enterprise as a whole?
Well, yeah, it just makes me worry that obviously the removal of chronic pain from a person who's returned to civilian life, that seems like definitely a good thing. But then again, the removal of pain from war seems in every conceivable way to potentially make war worse, to mean more people would end up being killed, more questionable ethical situations would arise. It just seems like it is a lubricant on the process of war. And the process of war ultimately is not a good process. It's like a thing that you want to limit the extent of however possible, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly there's a whole discussion here to be had about the use of drones in combat. And I guess ideally if you had drones battling drones,
yeah,
without any human element involved, which is largely not what we see in the current state of drone warfare. It is generally drones versus
humans.
But if it were just drones against drones, then I guess you could say, all right, well, less fewer humans are being hurt. And it's all taking place at the robotic end. Like I think there's a classic episode of Star Trek that explored a similar scenario.
Let me try to explore a counter scenario. Because it seems to me that every time you make war easier, mm-hmm, things somehow get worse without you imagining it. Like you can imagine the introduction of air power,
right,
in some ways made war easier. So now you could inflict massive damage on the enemy by dropping bombs without having to like physically send soldiers into an area. And yet, you know, that might sound more humane, but actually it leads to more deaths in war over time just because it's so much easier to inflict all that damage. So let's say we make it way, way, way easier and you don't even have to have human soldiers in battle. It's just your drones versus their drones. Well, I'm thinking even more. So if you have robot versus robot warfare, then that would maybe lead to even more destruction of infrastructure, which has downstream effects on public health and on the ability of economies to produce the necessities of life and things like that.
Yeah.
It seems like part of the problem is that pain is a necessary part of war.
Yeah. I mean, you can think of, in a way, you have to think of war as this sort of infection on the body of humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts and it needs to hurt because if there is too much of it, then it totally ravages the host. There has to be a certain amount of pain associated with it, and a pain that is appreciated at every level of society.
I absolutely see that, and I think I agree with that in the abstract. But then again, if you come down to the individual level, an individual soldier may be hurting, and they don't want to hurt anymore, and it's hard to argue with that.
Yeah. So that's kind of the conundrum that we're perpetually stuck with, right?
Yeah.
How to help those that are damaged by war, how to prevent war, but also make sure that we're really good at it. Gosh, I mean, it's all kind of intertangled too. When you get into the idea of a military technology as a deterrent. But in all of this, and I realize that we cover a lot of ground in this episode, I feel like we keep coming back to the idea that to make a more perfect warrior, we kind of have to be willing to make a more damaged person. Because what sort of soldier outside of our sort of Captain America fantasies can be pushed and pushed and pushed through traumatic situations without either breaking or being pre-broken? And it would seem we're talking about the best ways to create the sort of damaged person who can thrive in these environments, some sort of bicameral warrior, a new age myrmidon to assail the walls of Troy. But if human consciousness has evolved, or if it is still evolving, then isn't it backwards to attempt to create such a being, to kind of create a more primitive mode of consciousness to thrive in this more primitive human endeavor?
Yeah, it might sound kind of trite to say, but I guess I have to say it. I mean, it feels like this irony or this tension highlights the underlying inhumanity of our projects of war.
Yeah. Now, of course, as we mentioned in the earlier stages of this episode, one individual's pain is not directly comparable to another's. Mm-hmm. And we do not have a lot of direct experience with warfare.
Right. We're looking at this from the outside. I mean, mm-hmm. neither of us have ever been in combat. We've never been in the military. And so we would definitely like to hear from our listeners out there who have been in combat or who have been around combat, who have been in the military. I wonder what your experience of this has been like, if you've felt this urge from the command structure to try to become this more painless robot or this less human type of creature in order to better achieve your combat aims. And what was that like? How did that change how you felt about yourself as a person? Or maybe I would be interested to hear if you didn't feel that way, if you never felt a pressure of that kind.
Yeah, by all means, get in touch with us. And you can do so via a number of various social media options. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and then also there is the homepage, stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find links out to all those accounts, as well as all of the episodes and various blog posts and what have you.
Big shout out, as always, to our excellent producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly via email to let us know your feedback on this episode or any other, or to let us know a topic you might like us to cover in the future, our email address is blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun season. Kings Island is now open on weekends.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.